recording artists, actors, and athletes against drunk driving. Yeah, you know we love it when the music does the talking.
And you know, the music stops when someone gets killed.
So never, 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 never let someone you know get behind the wheel if they've been drinking. So keep it real, keep it real. Friends, don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hey, if you're still at work, leave. You're in 1957 here on Time Travel. You ever see the end of talk radio where, like, Bogosian comes downstairs and, like, this fat guy comes out and shoots him? I'm kind of expecting that may happen to me one day. Here we are in 2015. I'm like, 2015? God, that's what time travel is all about. Everyone's like, hey, you think in the past all the time. I'm like, I got a show called Time Travel. I have to think in the past. We're in 1993 here on Time Travel. We're in 1993 here on Time Travel. Let's go to 1969, for God's sake.
Eight years time travel has been on the air. Like, Chris is doing his eight-year anniversary show.
It's crazy.
For God's sake, strap yourselves down!
There's LL Cool J having sex in the car. Good for him. Somebody's got to. Time travel with Chris Earl, WMFO. 91.5 FM.
91.5 WMFO Medford.
I'm walking. Here's the thing, and I'm talking. By you and me, I'm hoping that you come back to me.
I absolutely adore that one.
Well, I have a hammer. And I have a bell. And I have a song. A song to sing all over this land. It's the hammer of justice. It's the bell of freedom. And the song is the song of love. Love between all of my brothers. And love between all of my sisters. All over this land.
Yeah, you said it, Mr. Spark.
My name's Chris Earl. I'm here with you until 7 p.m. You're listening to WMFO Medford, Massachusetts, 91.5 FM on your radio dial.
You're listening to Time Travel with Chris Earl. Here with you till 7 p.m. My guest today is Paul Earl, my dad. Happy Father's Day.
To whom she used to sing this song. Hey, Daddy, I want a diamond ring, bracelets, everything. Daddy, you wanna get the best for me, Leah. Hey, Daddy, gee, won't I look swell in sables, clothes with Paris labels. Daddy, you wanna get the best for me. With a bit of stimulation, I'd be a great sensation. I'd be your inspiration, Daddy. I want a brand new car, champagne, caviar, Daddy. You wanna get the best for me?
Amelia, Leah. Hey, Daddy G. Won't I look swell in sables, clothes with Paris labels, Daddy? You wanna get the best for me? La da 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 da. Here's an amazing revelation. With a bit of stimulation, I'd be a great sensation. I'd be your inspiration, Daddy. I want a brand new car, champagne, caviar, Daddy. Daddy, you wanna get the best for me, la da.
You're listening to WMFO Medford, Massachusetts. It is Time Travel with Chris Earle. My guest today is my father. Paul Earle is here with me today. How you doing, Dad? Welcome back.
I'm doing fine, Chris.
You're getting prepared over there. You brought in a some newspaper clips today. What is it? It's all headlines. So this is the front page of the Fall River Herald News. Is that what that is?
Right. The Fall River Herald News. I grew up in Tiverton, Rhode Island, which was a suburb of Fall River, Massachusetts. And this is the memorable 1940s as recorded in the Herald News. So these are headlines from the big war.
So we started off in the 40s, and I thought today what we could do here, this is probably your sixth or seventh time that you've been in the studio with me, and we've done this once before, which is jump from the 40s up until now. We'll play a couple of songs from the 40s and 50s and go forward, and figure we start here in the 40s here. So that other one, I believe, was it Glenn Miller I started with? No, Sammy Kaye and his orchestra with Daddy, and this is Julie London in the background with the same song from a few years later. So the memorable 1940s. So why don't you pick out a page or two there? Are you just open them at random, or did something catch your eye when you were flipping through it?
Well, what always catches my eye is, what were the headlines when I was born?
When you were born, I was just going to ask that. So we're going back to February 1943, right?
Right, February 9th, 1943.
So do they have the actual date of February 9th, 1943? I may be able to find something on the computer for
well,
us, too.
Well, we're close. We got the headlines from February 1st, 1943. And these are historic scenes from the Casablanca Conference with President Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill.
So when you were born, the war was still going on. It hadn't finished yet.
Every day.
Yeah.
Pearl Harbor was December 7th, 1941, and then that's when we entered the war. I had a brother born January 7th, 1942, and I came along 13 months later.
So what was it like? So you got the February 1st, 1943. What's happening? There's a President Roosevelt, and he's doing a speech, or what was he doing that day? What was he talking about?
Casablanca, right, is in Morocco, I think, right, North Africa, and he had a meeting with Winston Churchill to discover war plans. So what's always amazing on reading this is we've come a long way. Mm-hmm. Remember, we were probably more people worked on farms, if you want to go back to 1943, and here we were fighting wars in both Europe and the Pacific and Japan, and I think 1 in 12 people, I think, was in the war.
Wow, 1 in 12.
One in 12. We had probably maybe 120 million people then. I remember the 1950 census was 140 million.
Wow.
That's when I was old enough to read the World Almanac. That's what I used to do. My father used to buy the annual World Almanac, and I was always fascinated by all the statistics.
Right, so most people are getting their news at this point from either the newspaper, or they're getting it from actual film, from going to the movies, because TV's not big yet.
Not even around.
Yeah.
No. Radio.
Yeah, so 1940, and radio, of course.
Radio, right.
Yeah. And so 43... I thought this would be a good question for you. So the early days, so you're born in 43, so say around, you got some early memory. What is the first memory you have? How about that? Can you think of the first memory that you remember? Well, going back, youngest?
My first memory is going way back is the fact that we were on the remnants of the 30-acre farm.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived in what was my grandmother's house, my mother's mother. And it was always... went from one widow to the next widow, because most men actually died from either heart attacks or strokes is a shame, or cancer.
Or the other women. Because, well, so this is Tiverton, Rhode Island, too.
And yep. men tended to marry younger women.
Mm-hmm.
So that I remember my grandfather was born in, my mother's father born in 1894,
mm-hmm.
and my grandmother in 1896, and my mother in 1920. And of course, the most unusual thing that was my mother's, my father was 30 years older than my mother, and older than both my mother's mother and father.
Uh-huh.
He was born in 1889. So it was sort of an unusual relationship. But my early memories are of, besides remembering my mother and father and grandmother, what I remember were the two cows and the horse we had.
All right.
So we had two cows. The older cows, the milker was Mary Ellen, and her calf was Susabella. We,
uh-huh.
we had a name. And then we had a workhorse named Teddy. And we had a dog named Prince. That's the most memorable things I remember.
No kidding.
And of course, my brother Charles. One of the saddest occasions was, now remember, no television, just radio.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother would listen to The Romance of Helen Trent.
It was what, radio series?
It was a daily radio series.
Okay.
About, and The Romance of Helen Trent. And this continued from the early childhood right into when we went to elementary school. We actually used to ride our bicycles home from school for lunch. And The Romance of Helen Trent was how a woman 35 and over could again achieve romance in life. Whatever her
problems were. Oh, it's so true now. Yeah.
So it's really true now.
Mm-hmm.
But that was what was happening.
Yeah, I looked it up. Romance of Helen Trent ran from 1933 to June 24th, 1960.
Wow.
So it was on the air for 27 years.
Wow.
Yeah, radio soap opera on CBS.
Right.
Yep.
Exactly. It was. In fact, it was on at 12:30. So it was on right at mid.
Around lunchtime.
Yeah, lunchtime.
Yep. Yep.
So we could actually come home, eat lunch. We lived a half a mile from the school.
Mm-hmm.
My brother would immediately put a comic book in his face. I'm talking about now in fifth, sixth, seventh,
so
eighth grade.
What'd you get for lunch? Half hour, hour?
It used to be three quarters of an hour.
Whenever you get back?
No.
They were strict?
Time was punctual. There were no stretch of anything.
Oh, no kidding.
No, yeah. No way. You weren't late for school. You didn't skip stairs into school.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was by the bells, and there was no variance. So you were late if the bell had rung and you were there.
Yeah, they ran it like military, right? All military.
Exactly.
Time.
The bell and authority, especially growing up in Tiverton, we had John Berg was the 6'4" ex-World War II sergeant in the Army,
mm-hmm.
and he ran his school just like he ran his Army career. And there were others there, too. Adam Imbruglia was a lieutenant, and he was in seventh grade. There were no fooling around. Carlton Brownell, he was another one. He lived to be 95. He was from Little Compton, Rhode Island. And he was one of the originals. His parents went back and, you know, built farmhouses and everything on the land. I can remember he lived to be 95 years old. He died about 10 years ago. And they had a big memorial for him, and it was total capacity.
Wow.
I wanted to go. There was no more room. But these were the days of strict disciplinarians. And what I remember going to school in Tiverton is you'd have some kids 16 years old who had stayed back, and they'd still be in fifth or sixth grade, you know, a few years behind.
How old?
16 years old.
They're in sixth grade?
They'd be in fifth or sixth grade.
Ugh.
Because they stayed back a number of times.
They must have just beat the hell out of all the other kids.
Well, you used to be able to get out of school at age 16.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd be sort of taking up space.
So they'd rule the school for a couple of years, and then they'd go work on the farm afterwards.
The farm.
Get some physical job.
Getting. And I can remember, we go back to disciplinarian. I can remember Carlton Brownell coming and knocking a kid on the side of the head and pushing him on the floor.
Wow.
Yeah, somebody who I still know now, and was a friend of mine.
I was going to the bus once in seventh grade, and the biggest kid in the class, his name was Scott. He was a jackass.
Yeah.
All I did was open a door. He was behind me. I was trying to open the door, and he came behind me, smashed open the door, and I said, "Wow, I just said, wow, because he like opened the door before me, and he took me and he threw me to the ground. And he says, you're a geek, Earl. That was it. And then he got on the bus like nothing happened. I was mad. And to this day, I still hold a grudge. I saw him at the reunion. I wanted to punch him in the face. That's how I feel 40 years later, almost. 30-something years later. But all right. So in the 40s, I thought this would be a good question, too. So you have people that are still in the war. The war is happening. But you also have people that have been in the Great War, World War One, and what we were talking about the other day, you actually had Civil War veterans that were wandering around, and they'd show up probably at like Memorial Day or July 4th. What was a July 4th back for a 10-year-old Paul Earl in 1953? What was that like?
Well,
what would you do?
The big thing was the VFW halls, Veteran of Foreign Wars, were loaded with people.
Mm-hmm.
And we had major parades, especially on Memorial Day. We lived on busy Route 138. It was necessary to Grandma to get the grass cut and everything all set up to her standards. But by July 4th, the big thing in Tiverton was the Lions Club Carnival came.
Nice.
To all Tiverton. Right. It came to the Pocasset School grounds. So this was a week of John Dugan. He ran the local Sunoco gas station, and he was president of the Lions Club. So I'm 10 years old, and we would go to the carnival. So all we wanted was money to go to the carnival.
Oh, sure.
And
yeah.
Play some of the games and this type of thing. So here's what finally happened to the Lions Club Carnival. For years, we looked forward to that. School got out, you know, probably the 20th of June, 3 weeks. And then we only had a week to go, and the Lions Club Carnival came in. And it came in for a whole week. And so that was a big event. And what was fun about the carnival, you know, it would end with fireworks, and it would also end up with some aerial performance.
Right.
So there was both performing on swings, and also I always liked when you climbed the pole, the person who would be on the pole, which had flexibility, and would just move back and forth. And you were wondering, is the pole ever going to break and the person come down?
So they were on the tightrope. They were on tightrope.
Well, we had the tightrope. Plus, we just had where you put your arms. You inverse yourself like you're doing a handstand.
Oh, okay.
And you move your legs and your feet to move back and forth. And everybody's on about how much flexibility does that steel rod have that goes up.
Wow.
So that was always the highlight of the comic. Guess how it ended. Eventually, the Lions Club was banned from bringing the carnival back because they used to have rolling like the balls into different colors, the gambling.
Sure.
And it was fixed.
Oh, boo.
And it ended, I forgot what year, probably somewhere in the 60s.
Right.
The 1960s.
That's too bad.
Suddenly no more Lions Club Carnival in town.
Oh, that's too bad. So they had like the bingo when you put the rubber balls out and you get a prize?
Exactly.
Wow.
It comes rolling down and goes on to something, but they nailed it, and then they discontinued. And here's what I always looked forward to. I always wanted to make sure I had a nickel left. Because we lived in the old farmhouse built in 1788. In fact, it was up for 200 years. It got taken down and moved to Connecticut, the remnants. But across the street at Dugan Sunoco was the old Coke machines, which had cold water in them. And you used to put a nickel in and pull the slot, and it would move one bottle, so you could pull that one out.
Sure.
So as long as I had the nickel left, the 6.5-ounce bottle of Coke was a nickel. And the glass bottle was worth 2 cents.
So that's not bad.
And Sunoco gas station, it was open 24 hours a day, so the machine was outside. So that way, I got a Coke for a nickel. I had 2 cents to take the bottle back to the AMP. That was the Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, which went bankrupt. There might still be a few around using the name. And that was the story of my life. I became an early addict of Coca-Cola.
And recycling.
To which I still drink today.
And recycling. The bottle deposit. Oh, so when was the bottle deposit? When did the bottle deposit come around?
Oh, it's after the 60s. I was still getting the bottle of Coca-Cola when I was in high school, Durfee High School in Fall River. I used to leave if I went to a math club, a science club meeting, I'd go by the local AMP, which was right behind the bus station in Fall River.
Mm-hmm.
And it had gone up to a dime.
It went up to a dime.
The Coke was a dime out of the machine.
Yep.
So that happened somewhere probably in the early 60s. But you still, the bottle was still 2 cents. I'm not sure when the bottle bill started. Did you check that online?
Yeah, I could check it. Container deposit legislation I'm looking up.
It's been a long time.
But at that point, too, they wanted the bottles back because they would send them back to Coca-Cola and get their money back for holding the product.
Well,
right?
they were reused. The bottles were washed and reused. So what used to happen is basically Coca-Cola or Atlanta, Georgia, they sell the syrup.
Right.
And you used to have the regional bottlers.
Right.
So even Fall River, New Bedford, Providence, Boston, there was a bottler in every town. So they bought the Coca-Cola syrup.
Mm-hmm.
They had the glass bottles. And just like milk used to be sold in quart bottles.
Right.
And all the bottles went back and they were washed.
Well,
until they broke and not reusable.
This says Massachusetts, 1983, 5 cents.
Yeah. Right.
But they actually had, like you said, the milk and Coca-Cola would have the bottles. And I remember what happened before 83. It would say no deposit, no return on them.
Exactly.
So you would also be able to get big bottles. I remember big, right. 33-ounce maybe Coca-Cola?
No, 32.
32? Quart. Yeah. Quart. So they'd have, right, exactly. So they didn't have the metric going. They had the quarts. But I remember sitting in Texas, so that was 81,
mm-hmm.
and they had all the glass bottles just sitting in the grocery store.
Right.
And I remember pulling off the caps because they'd have games, and sometimes right. you could open up some of the caps, and they'd have money, and you could actually turn them in. So I went in, and I used to take the caps from the bottles so that people didn't play the game caps for Coca-Cola down in Texas.
Yeah.
And that was in 80, 81. Yeah. So this said... Massachusetts 5 cents in 1983. There's actually only a few that have deposit regulation in the U.S. It says states that have canned deposits: California, Connecticut, Hawaii, Iowa, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, New York, Oregon, and Vermont. And Delaware used to have it, but they abolished it in 2009, replaced by a universal recycling law. But this is kind of interesting. Over the past 10 years or so, we've seen recycling change quite a bit with the big blue barrels and now the giant green barrels and cutting up your cardboard and your glass and compost and what's trash anymore. Nobody seems to know. Everybody just kind of puts it in one of them and takes their best guess. But so 1953, the other thing then, and this is especially true with young boys, everyone likes explosions, especially young boys, fireworks in the 50s. Well, so what were these July 4ths like with the fireworks? What did they have?
At that time, the fireworks came out of Connecticut. That's what I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Massachusetts, Rhode Island didn't have fireworks. But basically, you had the normal 80 packs
mm-hmm.
of firecrackers.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had the salutes. And then the ultimate, if you had some cherry bombs.
Yeah.
Wrapped in the foil.
So that was big. So the cherry bombs came wrapped up in foil?
Yeah. So, they were always around. People mm-hmm. always came in with them. And even today, they sort of relax on the real July 4th.
Yeah.
Everybody's allowed to shoot fireworks. And, of course, now we're selling them.
Yeah, right up in New Hampshire.
Well,
Massachusetts, it's still not legal, but people have them, and they do take kind of turn a shy eye on July 4th, and you can usually blow off some fireworks on the 4th. But I remember as a kid, going back to the 70s and 80s when we went down to South Carolina and went into south of the border and seeing those giant fireworks stores. That was big for a young boy, seeing all those fireworks. It amazed me how many fireworks existed and what you can do with them. But I always thought that was always fun going to those July 4ths, and especially in small towns, and that's changed over the years now. Some of the stuff that you get now is just crazy. We had a firework. It must have been one of the loudest explosions I think I've ever heard over my friend Winston's house, and we lit it off on New Year's. a number of years ago, and the neighbors came over and said, well, what's the plan for the night? We're like, well, it's New Year's Eve. And he's like, well, how, and basically he was saying, stop with the fireworks. Yeah. And it was right. About 1 a.m.
Well, yeah, it does.
But his wife made him come over because he had a new baby, and he had his flashlight out asking us what we were doing. We're like, we're blowing off fireworks. Yeah.
Well, the worst thing, it upsets the animals.
It does upset the animals, too, yeah.
Especially, like, if you got horses. I can remember I got a sister-in-law, and mm-hmm. she lived next to some people with horses. So mm-hmm. that can be very, very dangerous.
So yeah. why don't you grab us two more headlines from 43 there and talk about a couple other things in the 40s
Well, you know what
50s.
Else is always fun to look at as I go through these? Some pages have food ads.
Mm-hmm.
And how much stuff cost.
So this is like a local A&P? That was the grocery
store?
Oh,
well, here's the First National store.
First National,
First National was A&P mm-hmm. and other stores. But, you know, some things haven't gone up that much in price. Butter was 52 cents a pound. Eggs, 46 cents a dozen. 8-ounce jar of mayonnaise, 15 cents. Peanut butter, 27 cents. So believe it. Believe me. Inflation's here.
Yeah.
And what I remember, think of it. The minimum wage in 1960 was $1 an hour. That's what I remember. Because I worked at $1 an hour. Mm-hmm. So now you're talking about $10 an hour.
So that was your first job, was $1 an hour?
And it was actually $1.05, but $1 an hour was the minimum wage.
What were you doing?
We were in Tiverton, Rhode Island. So because my grandma knew Arthur Davenport, had gone to school with him, and he was the foreman for the contract to maintain the storage fuel depot for the Air Force mm-hmm. in Tiverton, Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
We had JP4, which is the jet fuel, and we had 115, 145 octane aviation gas.
Mm-hmm.
So the large piston engines, airplanes, which existed then, that's what they took.
So it was a bunch of fuel, and they was hiring young boys to watch it?
For $1.05 an hour. And what I
to
remember
to be like security
was,
guards, or what were you doing with it?
Fire watch and fire.
Really?
And maintaining the dikes and loading gasoline.
Wow.
For $1.05 an hour. And we always heard, I never verified it, but supposedly at the Union Shell Oil Company docks in Fort River, mm-hmm. they were making, you know, $4 an hour for doing the same thing.
Well, they were probably adults, so they were hiring a bunch of kids to do it for $1.05.
You had to be 18.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
To do it.
Yeah.
But what I remember was, especially here I was, the ultimate job. Now this was my first summer, so I had come back for summer vacation after finishing my first year in college,
mm-hmm.
and they let me go up and gauge the fuel tank,
mm-hmm.
which is a really responsible job.
To gauge the fuel tank?
Gauge the fuel tank to see how deep it is to the gasoline level
uh-huh.
and how much water is in it. I don't know if I've ever told you this story. I think maybe
no.
I have.
No, I don't think so.
But here's what you got to do. The fuel tank holds 177,000 barrels of gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
The ones we had, they were big ones. And they were right on the shores of Narragansett Bay, Mount Hope Bay. And you have to go up to the top. Now, this is July and August when it's hot mm-hmm. and sunshine, just like today.
Yep.
So the first thing you got to do is probably a small hatch that's about 6 inches wide with a cap on it.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you open that up, and if it's 10, 2 o'clock, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
the first thing that happens with gasoline or JP4 is all
it's
the fumes
right?
come out.
Yeah.
All the fumes come out.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen White Heat with James Cagney.
Oh, yeah.
It's an
yeah.
old favorite.
Long time ago, yeah.
And in the end, the storage tank farm is blowing up.
Right, right.
Right. And
well, my next question was, did anybody get injured?
No one ever got injured.
But there were kids high on the fumes of the fuel.
Well I the winds blow on Narragansett Bay. When you see which way the fumes are coming, you stand on the other side.
Yeah.
And this is no. Sometimes it take 15 minutes, 20 minutes for all the fumes to come out.
Wow.
Before you could even grab the tape in.
No kidding.
So what you do is you have a tape, and you have a little rod at the bottom of the tape.
Mm-hmm.
And on the rod, you coat it with a little jelly, and you drop it down until you see the ping. Mm-hmm. You're on top of the gasoline, and then you take a measurement, you know, the fuel tank, you know, maybe the total fuel tank might have been 40 feet.
Uh-huh.
So maybe if it's down to 20 feet, then you got a lot of fumes in it with the heat.
Yeah.
And you take that reading.
Yeah.
Now, the other reading you got to tape is when you have a partially empty tank, and this is one reason you should always leave your, you should always fill your gas tank up in your car, especially in the wintertime.
Yeah, right.
You know, if it's down, you don't leave it a half because you get condensation every night
mm-hmm.
because it cools off. So the next thing you got to do is you got to drop it down and measure the water.
Mm-hmm.
So you put a different salve on it, and you could go down and see what level the water was, and you know how deep the tank is. So if the tank's 40 feet deep,
mm-hmm.
you know, you go down 20 feet to the gas, and then you go all the way down to the bottom, and then you can find out when you hit water,
mm-hmm.
maybe you've got 8 inches of water in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, eventually you got to get rid of the water, but you get condensation all the time.
So how many gallons and were these?
177,000
barrels.
Yeah, barrels
wow.
of gas. 52 gallon barrels.
Wow.
Oh, you've seen that. But
no smoking on this job, right? No smoke breaks?
No.
That's why they picked you, because you didn't have smoke breaks.
No, believe it or not.
They wanted the non-smoker doing that.
Believe it or not, smokers did the job.
Well, yeah, I'm sure they did.
Poncho from Fall River. Poncho used to sit there, roll his own cigarettes with paper and cigarette,
mm-hmm.
and he actually used to be...
Poncho?
Poncho was his name. He was Portuguese-American.
How old was he? Was he the...
Oh, he was probably 60 years old. Oh,
all right, so he was the first boss?
Yeah, because the major job besides gauging tank was cutting the grass with a scythe.
Mm-hmm.
You know what a scythe is? The old two-handled scythe?
Yeah, it's the old two-handled,
When you look at medieval times?
Right, right.
Scythes have been around, for centuries.
Yeah. See, I always called it a Sith. It's scythe?
It's a scythe.
Does it call it a scythe, huh?
It's a scythe,
see,
yeah.
I always thought it was a Sith, because death carries one, too.
Yeah.
Right? Death, the personification of death, the old skull and crossbones and the gray cloak.
Okay. Yeah.
He carries a... I always thought it was a Sith. I guess it could be a Psi.
Yeah.
I could have been pronouncing it wrong for 44 years.
Yeah, you look it up. Yeah, Psi.
Yeah.
Because you look it up. I mean, long before we had mowing machines towed by horses even.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If you want to go back centuries ago, everybody had to sigh everything.
Uh-huh.
So all the hay for the horses, the cows, the goats... The sheep, everything had to be scythed. So it was laborious. So everybody hated the scythe. And a lot of times we'd take breaks and somebody would sit up on the gangway going up to the tank and they'd be on watch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there we are.
That's it, right?
Yeah
it's scythe.
Yeah.
Right? Are you saying scythe or are you saying psi, like S-I?
My grandma called it the
scythe. She called it a scythe?
Yeah, I don't know.
See, I always called it a scythe.
I guess it is.
It could be both.
You're looking at... We used to have... There's a two-hand one with a curved handle on it.
Right, right.
Especially to do hay. And that used to be... That was the main work.
Mm-hmm.
It was more fun to load the tank cars.
So what was the first boss's name? Do you remember?
Arthur Davenport.
So Arthur Davenport is the person that hired you? He was on the job or did he just hire you and then let everybody work?
He was the foreman. He'd come and go. The one thing we knew was every Sunday... So a lot of times it was covered working there 24 hours, 7 days a week. And so we were also on fire watch.
So you're 18 years old. This is your first legit real job.
Real job. My
so
brother
you're going
Charles
to 19,
is
so 1961, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
And Charles is there too?
He's there.
My
yeah,
Uncle Charlie's
we
there
both
too?
Had a yeah. Yeah, he took the money he made and he bought a flight fish.
What did he buy?
A fly fish. That was like sunfishes, sailfishes.
Uh-huh.
That was like one of the first foam,
like a
sailfish or something, like a boat. That's
oh, okay, like
did.
A little sailboat.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, okay. I know what you're talking about.
That's
all
right. What he did.
So you both had the job at the same time?
Yeah, we both had the job.
And how many hours a week would you work?
It was a 40-hour week.
40-hour week?
Yeah, it was.
So how long did you stay there?
And sometimes. No, just 2 months.
Two months?
Just the summer. It was just the summer.
2 months. That's not bad, though. That's fine. 2 months is like forever when you're 18 years old.
Yeah, and realize OSHA didn't exist then. So
right.
I used to think breathing the JP4, the jet fuel, was
awful. Oh,
they
had to be bad. Yeah.
It had to be bad.
Had to be bad.
So his...
It's making
his,
a lot of sense now, Dad.
Think of it.
You had a lot of jet fuels when you were a kid.
Think of it now. These are the big railroad cars that carry fuel. We were sending fuel to both Otis Air Force Base on the Cape, so mm-hmm. that was a major base,
mm-hmm.
And we were sending it to Pease Air Force Base in New Hampshire. So these were the days of the huge, you know, B-29s still around,
mm-hmm.
B-47 had started, and the B-52, they were all flying, so they used all the jet fuel.
Right.
You know, North American Air Defense Command, NORAD, and the refueling tankers, mm-hmm. they used quantities of gasoline. Huge, massive usage of planes. You used to see the planes flying in the sky, you see the contrails, and you see the unburned gas.
Right.
Before you got all these modern jet engines. I mean, the Boeing 747 came around in 1957.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ever saw an old Boeing 747, you just saw smoke coming out of the exhaust as they yeah. took off. And we got the efficiency.
And also back then, like, the EPA didn't exist, nothing like that. So you'd yeah. be out and you could be walking through the woods and see an orange puddle anywhere, an orange pond.
Well, let me tell you what happened.
Mm-hmm.
We're going, and I wouldn't even want to. The tankers would come in, and they're loaded with the aviation gas,
mm-hmm.
the JP-4. When they're all done loading, they have to put seawater in for ballast.
Mm-hmm.
A tanker doesn't go to sea unless it's loaded with either the gasoline or seawater.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem becomes when the tanker comes in, and we'd get to go on the tankers and help ourselves to food in the refrigerators.
Uh-huh.
They were real nice. They made good money. The next thing I know is when you're all done filling the gasoline storage tanks, pumping the gas up,
mm-hmm.
you've now got the bottom of the barrel fuel, which is mixed with the seawater.
Mm-hmm.
And what are you going to do with it? Because it's in the lines, right?
Right.
So we used to
dump it,
drain all that fuel into 52-gallon storage drums.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to take it in the car. You know, a car pulled by a tractor.
Mm-hmm. Cart pulled by a tractor.
Mm-hmm.
And
take it up the hill and dump it around the dikes.
Really?
Around the tank.
They just toss it around the dike.
Yeah. And we used to wonder why. 1955 is a particular year I remember. I'm 12 years old.
Yeah.
And I went sailing. I used to sail on the bay, and, mm-hmm. and we used to race. And suddenly we're going down the Providence River to a sailboat race at the Edgewood Yacht Club,
mm-hmm.
in Rhode Island Yacht Club. That was one of the weekends of the 60s with Charlie LaRue, who you met,
mm-hmm.
and sailed with once. And his dead fish by the millions in the Providence River.
Wow.
So the Save the Bay program eventually turned on in Rhode Island to save the bay.
Wow.
Because
all they had to do was stop the cart.
Those are the type of things that used to happen.
Wow.
Those are the type of things that were happening back in the 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah. We literally had no concept that the earth couldn't take in anything we dumped, no mm-hmm. matter where we went.
Right.
And I'll go on.
You thought that the ocean would just, you know,
Suck everything up
and then be fine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the big thing was you'd wait for the moon tides
uh-huh.
to take the garbage out of Narragansett Bay into the ocean.
And then the waves brought it back.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when we talk about just the good old days,
yeah.
but there's the pros and cons. Which also brings to mind Borden's Wharf.
Yeah.
We used to go, all these old wharfs were around from the sailing days, just like the Boston waterfront used to be.
Sure.
We had thousands of wharfs.
So you're going swimming down there, or you're going for fish and...
We used to go down to Borden's Wharf, which was about... Tiverton was right on the Fall River line.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to go back to the 50s, Fall River didn't have a sewage treatment plant.
Mm-hmm.
The sewage dump got dumped into the bay too. Not just the tank farm that I was working at in the summer of 61. and Fall River worked on their first sewage treatment plant, which I think opened probably in the late 50s. But if I go back to being 10 years old, the word used to come, we can't go swimming at Boston Wharf today because Fall River's dumping sewage into the Saconic River.
But it'll
River
be
there.
Fine by next weekend.
It'll be fine, especially after the moon tides take
you're
it
just
out.
Just got to let it settle.
Oh, yeah. Plus the Navy.
Yeah.
The Navy used to be in Newport in the 50s.
Right.
We sail by. There's what they call a destroyer tender, and then the smaller destroyers. Mm-hmm. You'd go see a destroyer tender, and you'd have maybe up to 5 destroyers on each side of the tender.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be in. You know what they used to do with the garbage? And then they used to unload stuff into
just
the
throw it right into the ocean, yeah. Right? But yeah. They didn't even wait until they got far out there. They just did it in the bay. Right.
So if you want to think back to, you know, as we look at World War II, there was no time to take care of all this. It just got done.
But the other difference now is what's the difference between the population of U.S. in 1950s and now?
Yeah, like
it's
I said,
radically different. Yeah, like if anything like that happened now, we'd be in real trouble.
Yeah, 140 million people in 1950, 340 million people now. We got another 200, you know, plus cars to take care of.
Yep.
So even the cars didn't have emissions.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, basically, and plus we didn't have plastics.
Right. Plastic didn't come until like the 50s and 60s, right?
Exactly. Floating all over the ocean. I can remember the bottles going from the quart milk bottle being delivered by the local Ford farm.
The glass.
Which was a half a mile down from where we grew up.
Yep.
And it used to get delivered in a little rack, and you'd have a little... well, my mom was home all the time, but a lot of people went off for the day.
Sure.
And have a little cooler, you know, insulated with like sawdust.
Oh, okay.
Just to keep the milk cold.
So they have
the
it
day.
Outside.
But we went from there. What I always remember was, so there were 4 of us. My brother used to drink 3, 4, even 5 quarts of milk a day.
Yeah.
We used to have to make a separate trip for Uncle Charles to the Ford farm on Sunday to get his milk because he had drinking all
the time. He was a growing boy.
Growing boy.
He was tall. What was he, like 6'3", 6'4"?
Uncle Charles, he was 6'1".
Yeah.
He was tall and skinny. And he grew. And I was the little brother, 11 months behind. I maxed out at 5'7½", and I'm sure.
So you guys were Irish twins. That was you were 11 months behind?
Yeah, just 11
months. Oh, I thought he was at least a year old, only 2 years old.
No, I could never take his hand-me-downs as you rolled the dungarees up.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I always remember. But if you want to go back, we went from the Ford farm to the first Cumberland farm opening in South Fall River about 1955.
Mm-hmm.
And here it was, a glass gallon of milk, 4 quarts, 49 cents.
49 cents.
With a... like 10-cent deposit.
And it was glass? It was a glass gallon?
It was a glass bottle. It was a glass bottle with a plastic ring to hold. Mm-hmm. And those were returnable and reused then.
Hmm.
That's how four. And it went from 49 cents to 59 to 69 to 79. What's the Cumberland Farm milk now? About 279.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be the cheapest place to buy milk, but now it's the Market Basket.
Right.
In fact, the Market Basket had a special last week for all you people out there. Well, $1.99 for a gallon of milk.
That's pretty good. That's not
imagine
bad.
Imagine that. Oh, yeah.
Well, everyone's buying the almond milk now and the soy milk. Those are the big things. I don't mind the almond milk or the soy milk from time to time, but who knows what the benefits are down the road. Another big story is we've been eating off these plastic plates that are made of petroleum for years, so who knows what the link is there with cancer and anything else going down the road.
Yeah.
You know, and then the cell phones, of course, have just been linked to cancer, and who knows, people will be looking back at us in 100 years and be like, well, they ate off of oil plates and had radiation going up to their head every moment of the day.
Yeah.
They're going to look at us like, the times are much better now. So, yeah, there is the good old days that you can wax poetic on, but there were also the problems like the environment, like we were talking about. So why don't we take a quick break here. We'll play a couple of songs. We'll be back here with my father. We'll talk about a little more of the 50s, and we'll get into the 60s and 70s coming up. And my father is here. His name is Paul Earle. My name is Chris Earle. The show is Time Travel. Been on the air since 2008 here at WMFO Medford, Massachusetts. And thanks for listening and spending part of your day with us. WMFO Medford, Massachusetts. High atop Curtis Hall. at the Tufts campus in beautiful Medford. Be back in a moment.
Sorrow, I can't keep the tears from my eyes. My son calls another man daddy. The right to his love I've been denied. My son calls another man daddy. He'll never know my name, nor my face. God only knows how it hurts me for another to be in my place. Each night I laid there in prison, I paid pictured a future so bright, for he was the one ray of sunshine that showed through the darkest of night. Today his mother shares a new love. She just couldn't stand my disgrace. My son calls another man daddy and longs for the love he can't replace. My son calls another man daddy. He'll never know my name, nor my face. God only knows how it hurts me for another to be in my place.
With You see, it's not how good you play, but how much you can pay. Daddy's money.
WMFO Medford.
Confessions of a Potentially Perfect Parent, brought to you by AdoptUsKids.org.
I might look like an adult, like a person who could possibly be a parent, but I have no idea how to talk like one. And everyone knows that if you want to be a parent, you have to sound good when you say things like, "Don't make me turn this car around," or "Because I said so," or "Don't make me come back there." I don't even really know what those things mean, but I know that I actually believed my parents when they said them to me. How did they manage to sound so convincing? Here we go. "Don't make me come back there." Ugh, no, that's not tough enough at all. Kids can sense weakness. "Don't make me come back there." Ooh, yeah, that's better. In fact, that kind of sounded like my dad.
Weird. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who would love to listen to you practice your dad voice. Call 1-888-200-4005 or visit AdoptUsKids.org for more information. This message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
Freeform Radio. Freeform Radio. WMFO. Medford.
We come on this loop, John B.
You're listening to Time Travel with Chris Earle. My guest today is my father, Paul Earle. It's our special Father's Day show. You've been in here for Father's Day a number of times over the years. You usually come in June. You've been on a couple other times over the years as well with other members of the family. So I thought we could talk about the 60s now, Dad. Like the 60s, I just saw a show on CNN, the 60s, and they have one called the 70s and another called the 80s. And I loved it. And they were showing things like the space race and the JFK assassination and all kinds of things that happened in the 60s, Woodstock and the new music, the Beatles and all that. It was a very exciting decade. So you've been on Earth for eight decades now. You're in your eighth. So which one really stands out as the most exciting in general and the most exciting for you? What do you think?
You're probably, it's the 60s.
Got to be the 60s? Yeah.
Because the 60s, I spent 4 years at Boston University, got my first job, and then I got my second job, which was working for Honeywell and Bull Information Systems for 39 years. But the most change in my life took place in the 60s, that's for sure. From the job on Narragansett Bay until I had a real job.
Right, right. So early on,
and the space race.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit about the space race.
That was phenomenal.
So you've got James Bond, which is also the international spy. So of course he's pop culture, and everybody's into that because what's going on with the Cold War there and us against the Russians. So what was that like leading up to late in the 60s where they finally put somebody on the moon? So you have all these early missions, and if you've seen The Right Stuff, which I know you have, it's a great, great movie, and it follows the space race. What was it like living in America at that time, and you're sitting there and you're glued to the TV for almost every mission that's happening, or what was it like?
Exactly right. I mean, there was a time I could say I watched every space launch, and especially and the exciting launch of the moon mission, but even before that, when John Glenn orbited the Earth, that really took everything off. I mean, in came, so Eisenhower went out, and it was really the quiet 50s for the most part. But by the 60s, so in came JFK and LBJ, and we had the change of administrations, and we had JFK saying, you know, we're going to get to the moon in this decade. And you had LBJ, and we had guns and butter. I mean, here we were, the great, all the civil rights. I mean, I went to BU, and Martin Luther King, you know, was a graduate of BU. He was probably the most famous graduate.
Did you get to see him speak?
I never did see him.
No?
But I can remember my Quaker roommate from Pennsylvania, he just thought it was the greatest thing in the world that we were at the same university that Martin Luther King had graduated from. And of course, LBJ and, you know, all the civil rights, it was just unbelievable. And plus, I had friends who, my friend Richie Toulon, who I still know, he's same age as me, 73, and he got out of Durfee High in 1961, and he headed into the Air Force.
Yeah.
So this was...
Well, that's an exciting time to be in the Air Force with space.
And you got to realize many of us had never been to the South. The only time I had ever been South was to go to Washington, D.C. back in 1956 with the Safety Patrol.
Like Civil Air Patrol or something like that?
No, the Safety Patrol. Now we pay crossing guards.
Oh, okay.
15, all right. 20 bucks an hour to cross the kids. Used to have what was called a safety patrol. So they were basically in Tiverton, they were people in 7th and 8th grade.
All right.
Because we only had an elementary school. We went to junior high in Fall River, 9th grade.
So you were a teenager and you're helping people across the street? Kids across the street and old ladies?
No, we were helping the students cross, like the crossing guards.
Oh, okay.
You've heard of it, haven't you?
Sure. Yeah, okay.
It was part of AAA.
All right.
And the state police.
Yeah.
The shop teacher, he made a flag for us. They used to say stop and go.
Nice.
And whatever. And you'd go out, you'd start to walk out on the road and stick it out, and you'd stop the traffic on busy Route 138 so the kids could come in, just like the crossing guards do now. All we had was a belt with a cross strap, and it was a white belt, And then if you got to be a lieutenant or a captain, you had like a red belt and a blue belt.
Mm-hmm.
But the top two people in the school, and I got to be captain of the safety patrol,